Our speaker, Cecil Williams, is one of the distinguished graduates of Perkins School of Theology. He has a few things more than just being a graduate of Perkins School of Theology to distinguish him. He was in the first group of black students that we had working for credit in Perkins. There had been some earlier students who had been enrolled on a semi-official basis because of restrictive laws in the state of Texas that made it illegal for us to have them in the buildings. But after the law was changed or rectified by the Supreme Court, Perkins went eagerly looking for a group of class black students, and Mr. Williams was one of these. He has been regarded by a number as the most well-known of that group, although as we look at the group, we find that all of them have had substantial service, not only to the church, but also to the black community. Now, Cecil has served churches in which there are all kinds of problems. I understand that the first church he served, he was regarded as too intellectual, too sophisticated, and played bridge too much by his congregation. And so there was a movement to get rid of him because he was just entirely too good at bridge. It was not very long till we found that he was really a Perkins graduate because he had a little difficulty with some bishops. And in truth style, he went from section to section. I believe he's found his mark now. He is in Glad Memorial Church in San Francisco. This is an unusual church by any kind of definition or standards which you wish to look at it, one that challenges to the extreme. Glad Church does have the benefit of having a foundation to give some substantial money to the programs that the church wishes to carry on. A bishop that preceded Cecil's coming to this church had to rescue the money from being spent outside the area in types of programs that most Perkins people would feel ill at home participating in. But when the money got back home, then there was a great opportunity for experiment. This church today is carrying on a number of experimental ministries. Some of you have seen reprints of stories written in the Wall Street Journal, and I mean front page stories of the Wall Street Journal, under such titles as Whither the Church, or What Can We Expect of Protestantism's Younger Group. The church that Cecil has been serving has others on the staff who are also experimentally oriented. And the church, because it does engage in experimental activity, frequently runs into some unanticipated activities. I'm not going to try to steal Cecil's thunder by telling you about these experimental programs or the kinds of unanticipated emergencies that arise. But I can say this, he, according to all reports, has handled them with coolness and aplomb. And we are proud to have him here as a worthy graduate of this institution, but one who has come back now to teach all of us, including the faculty. But I hope he doesn't kick us too hard.
Down there.
They got my number in
Atlanta. Oh, both of us better stay away then. I better preface my talk by trying to, if at all possible, disconnect any images that you, those of you that knew me when I was here up until 1955, disconnect any images that you had of me then and how you see me now, if at all possible, because I was very disturbed when I came to the General Conference last year and met a number of the fellows that I'd gone to Perkins with. When they said to me, man, you've changed so much. And after being around them for a span of time, I said to them, man, you haven't changed. And really, it bothered me. I think they expected to see a nice nigger, the one that they thought existed at that particular time. But they didn't know that in 1955, Cecil Williams made a decision in his life to begin to move from something that he had been trying to be, which never existed, to something that he ought become. And most of the fellows had not seen me in 13 years up until last year. I don't know why many of them got it in their minds that I should be like I was 13 years ago. I was sure disturbed, however, that I found them somewhat the same way. And I kept saying, you know, what is the church really about? Because if its ministry has not, if the content of its ministry and the meaning and the nature of those who bear witness to the ministry have not wrought serious and radical changes in the lives of those who profess to proclaim the gospel, is something wrong, baby. Something wrong with the church. But when I said that, I thought about what the church, you know, really is supposed to be, or what the church is. And I said, well, the church is the community, is it not? Is it not the body of people? Is it not the people? And if the people don't change, it's something wrong, man. By the way, I'm going to talk the way that I talk in the ghetto and the way I talk when I preach at Glide. Because you see, in 1955, I decided that I was going to, first of all, accept myself for what I really was, and that was to be a black man. I could not couch it in those terms at that particular time, and I did not couch it in those terms until 1966 when Stokely Carmichael said black power. And it was at that particular time that I began to understand the decision I'd made in 1955, when my wife said to me, Cecil Williams, you act, talk, she was not my wife then, still I was dating. Said to me, Cecil Williams, you act, talk, and respond like a white man. And I was really doing that, man. I was trying to be somebody I wasn't. Because I knew the only way to make it in the Methodist Church and in the system, really, was to be white. And you know what? After I decided to be black, I said to myself then, you know, what's been happening to me? I could never be white. You know, I've been using bleaching cream. If you want to know something, baby, that doesn't work. And I have been working desperately to try, if at all possible, to straighten out this kinky, curly stuff called hair on my head. A lot of other things. And it didn't work either. The thing that really perturbed me, though, was the fact that I saw so many white people going out trying to get black like me, standing in the sun all day long, for instance. I said, what's wrong with those fools, you know? They must be crazy, baby. They really must be crazy. And then I moved on and I saw women going in, for instance, white women going in the beauty salon, standing all day long trying to get their hair curled up and all that kind of jazz. And I said, you know, they got to be more than crazy now. Like, they really are fools, there's no doubt about it. But it was at that point that I think significantly the development of my life in regards to what happened from 1955 on began to bring out some very definitive aspects of things that I've been suppressing in my life all along. And as the militants would put it, my mind had been so programmed, you see, that the only way I thought I could become and be a part of a system that I wanted to be accepted in was to be somebody that I was not. So between my wife and however God acts in history, you know, like something really happened, man. Now, I've been trying to think about what I talk in regards to, especially, you know, coming back to Texas and trying to deal with what I see, for instance, as the most fertile ground for revolution, namely the Bay Area, and specifically San Francisco. what I see as some of the revolutionary tendencies and some of the most important upheavals that we have occurring on the West Coast, and how, as a church, the position that we've taken in regards to our theology, our methodology, and then how we engage in it as it relates to our commitment. And I think my first conclusion is the fact that I am convinced that what we have to do more than anything else at this particular time as the church is to enhance polarization. I'm convinced that for a long time we have felt very strongly that reconciliation means standing between the two poles. That we have thought that as the church we had the power to reconcile the opposing forces, that we could bring it off, in other words, that we would be able, for instance, to get them to engage in what some people call dialogue and communicate with each other and all this kind of jazz. Well, it ain't happening. The church ain't doing it anyway. And if it is in fact taking place, it's taking place because the two poles have reached a point where they know that if they move to any other extremes, they're going to fall off the world. And no group really wants to die, finally. See, that's why I think polarization is important. I'm convinced that no one group really finally wants to terminate its existence. And there are a lot of groups whose existence we find from time to time either have been terminated because of certain directions and decisions that they've made, internal kinds of things that create conflict, or, on the other hand, there are those kinds of forces which impinge upon that group from the outside, which in fact determine the length and the breadth to some degree, as well as the mode of operation of that particular group. And therefore, sometimes, because of the external forces, the groups are the group life is terminated, or the group thrust is terminated. But I am convinced that, first of all, the important thing is the fact that we must enhance polarization. Secondly, that in enhancing polarization, we are able to a greater degree to have those forces, the haves and the have-nots, the poor and the, you know, whatever you want to call them, the rich, big, we call them the big fat cats, I don't know, but the big fat cats, the black and whites, the great strikers and the farmers, the black, third world, white radical groups of San Francisco State, and the governor, and the board of trustees. We go right down the line, you know, wherever you go, the whole thing about the generation gap, the young, the old, all of these things, that in a great sense, what we do is, after they're polarized to such extremities, that there is a point by which, because of mere survival, the fact of survival, that they do, in fact, then don't want to have to terminate their existence. And there are points, then, by which they begin to come back toward each other. And it's at these points that they come back from what we call a base of power. And remember, those groups, I don't know why I keep saying, when I talk about the haves and the have-nots and all these other cats, I use my left hand. And when I talk about the governor and all these other cats, I try to use my right hand. But anyway, I'm convinced
minutes, that the important thing that develops in this kind of situation is that those groups who have not had power must in fact have it if they are to not only continue to survive, but if they are to have then that kind of relationship and that kind of life which will provide more than just the act of survival. Power comes then when you're put in a position to deal with those who hold the power, when you're able to negotiate on a level and from a base of power. Now, part of the problem we face through the years, I must be very emphatic about white liberals, is the fact that white liberals have not had a base of power, a serious base of power. I didn't know it was going to cause that chair to move. Sorry. All right, I'll say that a little quieter the next time. Well, the problem we face, I think, is the fact that to a great degree, when one looks at where the bases of power are expressed and exemplified and initiated and in the thrust that we have coming forth, it's usually from what we may terminate what may be called the conservative segments, pockets, power pockets of America. It's not the liberal. We don't have that much power from what we call the white liberal stance in America at this particular point, as far as I see, especially in the urban South. So I think the church has to enhance polarization. What I think we've got to do is push as desperately as possible. That is, if we believe in those who have not been able to gain power, that they must in fact have power, then we must push as desperately as possible to help them to have power. And notice I didn't say get saved. I noticed I didn't say be revived. You know, I don't know. We don't even use saved. We can't use it blind anymore. We just can't. Certain terminology we just can't use now. What I talk about is, in fact, what we must do is help liberate people, you see. And the thing that we're basically concerned about is how do you help really liberate a man? That man must have a semblance of power if he is, in fact, to be liberated. Therefore, the church has to ask the question, you know, what about the use of power and how do we get about enhancing those who are powerless to a position by which they may be liberated to have the power by which they can enact their lives? Now, I'm going to talk about power a little later on, but I want to continue to push this for just a few minutes. You know, whether you like it or not, and whether I like it, I don't know how it is down here, but on the West Coast and on the East Coast and in the Midwest, we can't stand between the two poles as a church. As they don't even care about where we stand when we try to stand between them. You know, it doesn't mean a thing to them. And I wish you could hear what they call us in the ghetto when we say, oh, we're the church and we've come to, you know, help you out. I wish I could use some of the terminology.
You can.
Can I? I had I took 2 weeks ago some of the kids from San Francisco State with me who worked on our staff, and a very interesting thing developed is that we went up to the bishop's office, my bishop's office. They wanted to meet the bishop, so I took them up to meet the bishop. And we got up there, these cats, you know, say whatever they want to say, and they say it the way they know how to say it. And I didn't know whether to get a little edgy about it or not, because, you know, I kind of use some things myself, especially at General Conference. I use a lot of words down there, you know, he adults from General Conferences. As I got very angry, I tried to get on the floor some 42 times, and they wouldn't let me get on the floor to speak. And I finally talked to some bishops about it, and they said, there's a conspiracy on to keep you quiet, which I knew was taking place anyway.
But anyway, we went up to the bishop's office and they were talking. So finally, at one point, one of the fellas all of a sudden realized that he was with the bishop. And he'd already said one of the most common words we use in the ghetto, that is used in the ghetto, is motherfucker, you know. And he said this word, and the bishop just said that. And he said, "Bishop, I just used..." And all of a sudden, the bishop said, "Well, you know, I sometimes I mean the same thing."
But I don't say it that way. The church that calls itself the church, which wants to stand between the poles, I think is going to constantly find itself in serious trouble. Finally, what I'm really saying is the church has to take sides. This is the time now that the church has to say, "Here's where I stand." And you can stand on the right or the left, you know, whatever pole you want to, but I think the church is at a point in its history where it has to say, "This is what I believe in. I stand here, and therefore I put myself on the line." There's a difference between what we call white radicals and white liberals. The radical is the cat who says, "Not only will I be with you, no, not only do I come to you, but I'm going to let you make the decision about where I ought be." It's very interesting. It's quite different from the white liberal who comes and says, "I want to work with you. Let us sit down and talk about terms and the way we'll do it." No! The radical says, "I will be with you. What do you want me to do?" This was the way we were able to bridge the gap and friend the black community just about 6 months ago at San Francisco State with the black militants. And I mean the most, you know, you name, we got some fine cats out there. I'm Eldridge Cleaver's sponsor, for those of you who've read his book, Soul on Ice. And the only reason I got to be a sponsor is because some years ago when he was getting ready to come out of prison, they needed a sponsor. And I read much of the material that he's written in Soul on Ice. And so his lawyer said, "Would you be a sponsor?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "You're going to get in trouble." I said, "I don't care." You know, but I didn't know Eldridge Cleaver was going to be Eldridge Cleaver, man. We tried to bridge the gap in the black community between the young people and the older people. What happened was that they finally reached a point in the strike where they said, "Momentum is diminishing," and I'd already sent out signals. You know, smoke signals. Black people can really use some strange smoke signals. Quite interesting. But anyway, I sent out signals. And I said, "You know, when you get ready for the black community to move, let me know." And they did. I was able to mobilize the black community very quickly because we've organized about 18 groups in the black community. And it's very easy to pull together that you've organized if you know what you're doing when you organize. I mean, sometimes we make some grave mistakes about it. Anyway, interesting thing that developed was the fact that when we went in with the young people at 9, to sit down and discuss the issues, they began to say, "Look, this is our thing, baby. And the only way you're going to make it with us, like, is to come in on our terms." And so the discussion began. Man, was it ever heated, because, you know, we had the cats who had been lead, you know, the black leaders, the respectable Negro leaders of San Francisco were there together with these hard, bad-looking cats, you know. And they were saying, "Well, look, I've been here 20 years. You don't tell me what to do." And the young cats were saying, "You work with us, you come in on our terms." And just happened that we were able to influence the group to get them to say, "Okay, we come in on your terms." And they did. An interesting thing that developed is after we went and put ourselves on the line and people got arrested and we got our heads clubbed and all that kind of jazz, the thing that developed is they said,
we now not only have no black Uncle Toms in San Francisco, but we now trust our black adult community. The only way the church is going to be trusted, I'm confident, this particular time in history, the only way the church is going to begin to really speak to those forces which are over here is that I'm sure that the church has to say, this is where I stand. I stand with you. And whether it's in the great strike, no matter where we are, as we face issues, it's got to be somewhat like this. And why am I pushing this point? Why am I pushing this point so much so? Is that I'm not convinced that there are people who believe that the world is really coming apart. I think that there are people who still believe that the world is nailed together, and that they, either from a privatistic kind of position or an individualistic kind of position, or a powerless kind of position which they won't admit is inadequate, or they keep saying, you know, we are really not interested in power yet. In the structures of the church, there are all sorts of power groups and blocks and segments. If the church really wanted to use its power, it could, by the way, which it won't. But I'm convinced that there are so many people who've not reached a point in the life of the church to realize that the world is really coming apart. Really coming apart. And I keep looking at some of the polls, for instance. I keep thinking about polls that engendered some movement during what we call the FSM crisis on the West Coast, around the University of California, and what these young people were saying, emphatically. We have been so structured and we've been so organized that there is no human possibility in the university community. For those of us who are students. And the administration and the other forces, Board of Regents who stood on the other side, and I don't say all the administrators, but that kind of thinking that came out of the administration, said emphatically, but we've got such a large university, we've got to structure it this way, and we're not really concerned about your humanization. Until you really get out, you know, you'll get it after you get out of school. And they said, no, baby, we're going to have it here, right here, or else. And they focused around certain issues and problems and fought that battle. And I think about the hippie movement, which we participated in very intensively from its inception. It has now taken like all kinds of directions and has diminished a great deal. And it's not there, but we see it. You know, we see all kinds of, some people said, well, the hippie movement didn't bring off anything. Yes, it did. It really did. It brought off a lot of things. But the tremendous schism between the hippie projection and its philosophy and its leadership, which they say they didn't have, but they had it anyway. And the adult community, which it was so seriously criticizing, and specifically white middle class America. I kept saying when I went up to speak before the Board of Supervisors, the serious problem is the fact that, and this was in the incipient stages of the struggle, is that you don't realize that these are your sons and daughters. And some of them laughed about it. Some of the very ones laughed about it. Supervisors came to us later on and said, would you go in the heat and find my child? We had set up Huckleberry House, which is, there's a paperback out of it now, for runaway teenagers. The State Department comes to us. People from Look, Time, New York Times coming to us, find my son, my daughter, help me, please. You know, calls every day, ambassadors from foreign countries, sons and daughters, coming to the Hague. And we're being contacted. And the interesting thing that developed out of this whole, you know, direction was the fact
that, for instance, the executives of IBM realized, the top executives realized that, for instance, they've got to change their whole understanding of training and education if they're going to be sensitized to some of their sons and daughters and what they're really talking about. We were told by a top executive just weeks ago of IBM that over 50% of the top executive's children have run off from home, from their homes. And that's some tough stuff, really. But more than that, I keep looking at the artifacts and the symbols that came from the hippie community, all sorts of symbols. One thing we were talking about on the bus with several folks, and that is that they were essentially concerned about a spiritual thing, which I don't think you probably heard too much about, or maybe you have. But a spiritual thing, which takes all kinds of dimensions, all sorts of directions. But they were seeking something which talked about an inner life, but that which had a spiritual thing which was expressed symbolically, not only in what they wore, but what they also had with them, or how they carried certain symbols. But basically, they were finally saying it's how we live with each other. And they were essentially trying to communicate to so many of us that we've lived what we have not professed. That we've been living a lie, baby. You know, as one would say constantly, it's phony, it's phony, it's so phony. At points, I think they exaggerated it. At other points, I don't think they did. But the important thing is that they created some changes. But let me tell you about one change that you're not probably too familiar with. Is it really, along with the birth control pill, really affected communal life, our life in San Francisco and in the Bay Area? I have not married a couple in the last 2 years that did not live together prior to the marriage. Like they've been staying together, man. Did you hear me? Every time I say that someplace, some people, you know, I can see them all getting ready, getting mad. A lady told me not too long ago when I was up in Washington speaking, and I said something about this. She said, "You were good until you got to that point." What I'm really talking about is that it, in effect, helped to put into reality the value changes to some degree, and especially those values which dealt with sex. And it brought off a new kind of style of life in regards to communal living, where you have maybe 5 fellows, 8 girls living together, or the reverse. And there are a lot of straight people doing it now. You hear me? You hear me? Openly doing it on the West Coast. I don't know what's happening. They may be still hiding down here, but anyway. Anyway, these kids are saying, you know, we're not going to live a lie anymore. If we believe it, we're going to live it openly. And that's it. And they're doing it. I can tell you of kids from Minnesota, Wisconsin, from Mississippi, Alabama, all around, who come to the West Coast and who probably have a lot of hang-ups when they get there about sex and about being intimate with people. But after they stay there for a while, baby, I don't know what happened. But they changed. You hear me? Now, I know that, like somebody told me not too long ago when I told them, I said, well, I'm not going to send my daughter out there. I said, well, she may make it without your consent, too. What I'm really saying is that there's a new thing going on in regards to sex, the morality of sex. The whole new hippie movement had something to say and to do. I think about that kind of toll, and I think about the division that exists, and I keep thinking that the world is really coming loose. Because there are those who don't realize that the world's really changing, man. Really don't.
One writer says that this world of ours is a new world in which the unity of knowledge and the nature of human commodities, the order of society, the order of ideas, and the very notions of society and culture have changed and will not return to what it has been in the past. One thing that is new is the prevalence of newness, the changing scope and scale of change itself, so that the world alters as we walk in it, so that the years of man's life measures not some small growth or rearrangement or moderation of what he learned in childhood, but is a great upheaval. End of quote. One of my most important poets that I often use in my celebration at Glide, he was at our place week before last in a big kind of thing that we had there. Lawrence Ferlinghetti puts it this way: I am waiting for the second coming, and I'm waiting for religious revival to sweep through the state of Arizona, and I'm waiting for them to prove that God is really American. And I'm seriously waiting for Billy Graham and Elvis Presley to exchange roles, seriously. And I'm waiting to see God on television piped onto church altars, if only they can find the right channel tune it on, and I'm waiting for the Last Supper to be served again with a strange new appetizer. And I am perpetually awaiting a rebirth of wonder. It's like some of the young people said, you older people have dreamed your dreams. We are now dreaming our dreams, and we are going to make them become a reality. There's a sizable young number of young people who've been talking about love, but they decided all of a sudden that they were not going to talk about it anymore, that they were going to make it, if at all possible, become a reality. And it has all kinds of ramifications, and I'm sure that there are all signs of manipulation, whether it be self-defeating manipulation, or you really want to read an interesting book, pick up Man the Manipulator. Very interesting little book that I came out not too long ago. It has all kinds of ramifications in regards to how people who are hurt, and the fact that they get hurt, and a number of other things, but essentially a sizable number of young people are saying, you know, we're trying to find out what it means to love, but this brings out other kinds of polarizations, I think, which are very interesting, which have to say something about one of the most fascinating things that I discovered when I read a book called African Genesis, which substantiated my position, but I already knew it, like it already happened. I recall having at one weekend some 6,000 people in our building for what they called an invisible circus, and baby, it was invisible too. You believe that? We got more publicity on that months after it happened. I'm glad it was months after it happened. I remember the press coming down that Sunday morning, saying to me, you know, like we were here the other night, but not as staff writers. And we had it was a beautiful experience, but how do we write about this? Give us some statements. And I said, I don't have anything to say today. And they said, that's not like you. You're going to say something today. And I said, I have nothing to say. I've done that one other time, too, but just recently. But I said, I don't have anything to say. And they said, oh, man, with all this you had going on, I said, well, you know, like, I didn't plan it. You know, I was sort of like a part of it, but I didn't know all this was going to happen, you know. Oh, it was really something. But that was Friday night. On Saturday, we expected 13,000 people in. Well, we can't get over 2,000 people in our place in the first place, you know. But like they had taken over all our office space and every place, all on the roof and every place. You know,
people, young people, all just everywhere.
I guess the interesting thing that developed was the fact that on that Saturday we decided we'd have to move to the beach because of it. The police came. Interesting thing about the police, they didn't come in that night. They used to come in quiet most times. They didn't that night. That Friday night, they kept saying, "How are things going?" And we said, "Great, great." Chief called me up the next day and said, "Cecil, is there anything we can help you do?" And I said, "Yeah, come on over." They sent two captains over. We talked, and we decided we'd move the happening out to the park. I mean, out to the beach, which we did. But the thing that really took place that we discovered more than anything else was that our walls and our beautiful sanctuary were literally, you know, filthy. And our walls and our beautiful fellowship hall were like really dirty. And had all kinds of poetry upon the walls. All kinds of poetry. And some of this you can't scrape down by Sunday morning, you know. One lady who went in the women's bathroom said, "I didn't know that that they wrote in bathrooms like this." And I said, "Well, most men's bathrooms I go in, they always have some kind of writing on them anyway." I said, "No, you ladies are just dead." She said, "But like that?" The thing that I discovered is that for church people, they were much more concerned about that building than they were about what had happened to the people who came to it. And then, you know, at that point, a lot of things, I began to reflect on what I'd been hearing a lot of people say as I've been working from place to place. I discovered that buildings and private property were like very important, you know, like the most important thing. I was delighted that Sunday in the celebration of that weekend that we had a lot of big Methodists there. Two bishops, for instance, and one cat who calls himself a cold fish who's high in the Methodist structure, cried in the celebration. Called my bishop and he said, "There's a revival going on here." And my Bishop Tippett then said, "Great, great." So I knew I had it made there. But anyway, what I'm really saying is what the author points out in Africa Genesis is that when we begin to discover some of the things that we've tried to avoid looking at very seriously about private property, we will see that it has very strong animal tendencies because animals are always trying to stalk out their territory and their turf to lay claim on it. And then I found the church people are the same way. Like some lady said to me, "Our church was so lily white and nice before you came." I said, "But it won't be like that no more, baby. You believe that?" Property, you know, the building. Oh, we had $5,000 worth of work to do on the building, but so what? That shocked a lot of people. I tried to keep it that way for weeks. They voted me down. I wanted to stay there. But we've discovered, and the young people have been saying for a long time, that the most important thing in life is human life itself and not property. You see? And this is another dichotomy that we find, another schism that we find, very serious split, polarization. Now, I really want to finally get into to what I really want to spend a lot of time on. And I'm trying to keep up with the time here. I really want to talk about what I see, the division, the poles that I see related to what I call the black and white confrontation, because it's there that I want you to understand that when I speak at this particular time, I must say without any hesitation that I'm doing it from what I call the black experience.
On page 203 of the Kerner Report, it stated emphatically, I was in debate with GM James Meredith a week before last, and we have a point of disagreement here, a lot of other disagreements, but right here, very sharp point. 203 of the Kerner Report, it says very emphatically that the real problem facing American society today, as we look at the issue of black-white relationships, is that of white racism. Meredith contends that no group is to really blame for racism in America. I contend that there is a group which is to blame: whites. Whites who emphatically have either had their minds programmed to the degree that they must think in terms of what may be called the superior-inferior frame of reference, which is racism, which is a sense of colonization, which is in a sense always putting, and a lot of people don't know they do this, putting as they respond to people, they're always suppressing those forces which are not in fact white men. I was talking to a white young lady who's married to a black man, and she said, "You know what racism is?" And I said, "No." She says, "It's the white man who acts without thinking." Because most white people have been programmed to think white and not black. And therefore, when they automatically act, it's always in light of their own frame of reference. And there are those of us who in the black, you know, black people who are saying from now on, "You're gonna think black also, baby." That's it. And some cats in 1963 in Watts finally decided that the way to really get the attention of the white man, to begin to get him to think like that, was to begin to destroy what he loved most. Now, having said that, then, the whole thrust when one deals with racism has to be couched in the terms, as I see it, if we're to rightly understand the essence of polarization that we have in between blacks and whites now. And there are some who are saying, there's no doubt about it, we're going to have just a separate black-white kind of thing, which I disagree with, because I'm going to point out the position why I disagree with it. I would have to strongly hold to the position of Stokely Carmichael and Charles Hamilton, who wrote the book Black Power, The Politics of Liberation in America. By racism, and I quote, "By racism we mean the predication of decisions and policies on considerations of race for the purpose of subordinating a racial group and maintaining control over that group. Racism is both overt and covert. It takes two closely related forms: individual whites acting against individual blacks, and acts by the total white community against the black community. We call these individual racisms and institutional racism. These acts are those which are very pervasive in American society." One of the big heroes of the black movement now is, of course, probably the most serious hero is Malcolm X. And I want to try to take some time to talk about his position to some degree, but I want to go on and say a little something about black power, because I want you to really understand it in its context. What is black power, and what does black power mean? It means nothing other than full emancipation, liberation of black people from white oppression by whatever means black people deem necessary. The methods may include selective buying, boycotting, marching, even rebellion. Black power, therefore, means black freedom. It means self-determination. It means dignity of black people who no longer view themselves as animals, which most of us have done most of our lives, for a long period of time, I tried to, you know, I kept seeing myself as less than white people. And even when I was at Perkins, it was going on, baby. It really was. Price Cobb says in his book, along with Bill Greer in Black Rage, that every black man is angry. And I would even emphasize the fact that most black people hate white people. All of them did at one time in their lives or another. And one reason they did is because they did not love themselves. We didn't love ourselves. And I want to say to you that one reason why you see a new Cecil is I finally got to loving myself. And I don't have to act like a nigga anymore. I act like a man. And I love you for the first time in my life, brother. When I was here at Perkins, I hated your guts because you wouldn't let me be. But I'm going to be from now on, you see, whether you let me or not. Because I already got it here and here. All of a sudden, I began to look at myself and appreciate myself for what I was. And I discovered that my big lips wasn't bad at all because they're pretty good for kissing at times. I got that quote from Rap Abernathy, by the way. I began to appreciate myself. I began to say, I'm not ashamed of being who I am and what I am. And I'm not going to let any man so dissect my mind to the extent that he makes it continue to think that I ain't, that I cannot become what I ought to be. I don't care who he is. I was with some black militants just this last week and said to them, look, man, you don't have to hate white people. And part of the problem, the fact that some of you still hate white people is that you haven't worked through your blackness. They all got their afros, you know, like this thing I got, you know, all this kind of stuff. And they're wearing that, all this African garb and everything else, but they still hate. And I said, look, man, you got to work through your blackness. When you work through your blackness, then you don't have to hate the man. Some of them still hate white people. They still have not worked through that blackness. I'm going to be honest with you, there's still some white people I hate. But it's like some of my brothers, too. I don't care for all them either. Black power means a sense of self, sense of pride. Dignity of accepting one's culture, of saying that out of the midst of my past, I can now begin to understand some of the things that took place, but they don't have to hang me up anymore. I can be where I am now and move on, man. Move on. As Bonhoeffer would put it, you know, in a sense, when I talk about black power, I'm saying that this is Christ existing as community, is Christ's presence in history. This means that the church's work and message is nothing other than a continuation of the work of Jesus of Nazareth. It is, like Bart puts it, God's provincial demonstration of his intention for all humanity. It's like saying, now on, I'm going to be here. Some people keep saying, but really, Cecil, are we really just talking about being human? Like a lady who wrote one of our bishops, black bishops, a letter not too long ago and said, oh, when you spoke, I didn't see you as a Negro or a black man. And he wrote her back and he said, I want you to know that I'm a big black man. I finally concluded by saying that power means the ability to act. Power requires money and people. There are two constellations of power, money and people. We don't have money, but black people are beginning to get together. Stokely Carmichael calls it TCB, T taking care of business. We're beginning to, some people say, you're separatists. I said, no, man, we're just taking care of business. Some people say, you're segregationist. No! White people had been saying to us all through these years, you people go back and get together. And we went back and got together, now they're saying we're segregating. Really? What the hell do you want? Really? As soon as we move in one direction, we're segregating. If I believed in segregation, I wouldn't be at Glide. If I believed in separatism, I wouldn't be at Glide. 60% of the people at Glide are white. But I'm taking care of business. We're taking care of business. We're getting together. There was a time that you wouldn't see black people. You know, when we were in integrated groups, we'd always run and sit apart, you know, from each other. We didn't want to be, you know, sort of like we're integrated. Now, first thing we do is when we see each other, we run and embrace. Hey, man. Well, really what I'm saying finally is just this, that, and I'm going to have to stop. What I'm really saying at this point is that in taking care of business, it simply means that we're trying to bring off a semblance of power. Martin Luther King puts it this way. He says that what we must have is a rugged sense of somebody-ness. And that's what we're trying to bring off. You see, I want to be somebody, and I'm going to be somebody. And no longer can any man tell me I'm not. My wife tells me that, but no man can tell me. I just want to say this about black power. That term would have, if the press had not used it, read Black Political Power in America by Robert Stone. You know, there's no doubt about it. If black power had been taken up and used in its, at that particular time, in its positive sense, as Stokely and others were trying to express it, it never would have had the negative connotations. But the press picked up on it and began to use it negatively, and what they said is that it means violence. Well, what they'd forgotten was that Watts erupted in 63. The term black power didn't come into existence until 1966. You see. And Stokely was talking about a sense of pride and a sense of taking care of business, getting together. And the press kept using the term violence. And you know what happened? Stokely and all other cats picked up on it and said, okay, if this is the thing that agitates the man, we'll use it. And they did. Now, what I want to finally say, I'm having to go way down here. I really want to talk about, which I may have a chance to say something about, I guess, after dinner, maybe a few minutes. But I'm convinced at this particular time in our history that the church has to be the community which sees itself using somewhat this methodology. This is sort of the one that we've used to some degree. First of all, we try to recognize what's happening in the world. And we do it by to be very honest with you, we don't have a Methodist structure, what we may call a Methodist structure in our church, by having task force. We just have task forces there. And we have all kinds of groups, 50 COs who work with us. Conscientious objectors and interns and all kinds of people. We have about 642 volunteers all over the city. And what we try to do is to get into the social fabric, the social milieu. And we go any place, every place. Somebody said not too long ago, you know, you see Cecil Williams any place. I said, yeah, so what? And we don't go incognito either, by the way. You don't have to do that kind of thing. You don't have to hide. But the important thing is to be in the midst of people. This is what we try. First thing, where the action is, as somebody would say. Secondly, one gets there, one has to understand that there are new vibrations coming out of these groups now. those that we have gone in with, many of us have gone in with preconceived ideas, preconceived notions about what's taking place. Baby, it's not like that. We got to get there and hear what's happening, like in a different way, like we've never heard before. So we got to be there and begin to hear, really hear what's taking place. The third thing is then begin to say, now, you know, what are you really saying at this point? Is this what you're saying? You know, are you really talking about these things? So we'll be sure that we can interpret, articulate, whatever the case might be, to the degree that we can mouth what people may be saying. You know, because sometimes we are not able to put it in that frame of reference, because even though we may know what they're saying, we can't put it in that terminology. The fourth thing is then one has to say, okay, this is where you are. I choose to be with you. What will you have me do? And then get about it. But you better make sure you're ready to move when you say that. Because baby, they're gonna take you and me all sorts of directions. You hear me? All sorts of things that we never thought we'd get involved in. And better make sure. But I guess the most important thing that develops is that out of this kind of context, as I see it, and those who have been rejecting the church, who don't believe that your church has it anymore, and a whole lot of stuff, who keep saying, yeah, man, yeah. We felt that the church knew about revolution. But now it begins to act that way. This is what Reverend Milton said to me not too long ago. Yeah, man. You're talking about Jesus Christ. Those cats know more about Jesus Christ than we do. Did you know that? And they talk it in their meetings. They talk about the revolutionary. Oh, Jesus is mad. Somebody came to church not too long ago. We always have guests in our church. You know, every Sunday somebody comes in curiously looking on. What kind of shit? Somebody came and said, after church, some of the ministers said, we wish we could preach like you. I said, what are you talking about, man? I thought they were talking about, you know, talking about the fact that I use jazzy language and all that kind of stuff at times. They said, no, we wish we could say what you say. I said, well, you don't have to say what I say, but it seems to me you ought to be saying something, you know. Wish we could say what you say. Well, I stopped now.